Welcome to the Visual Impact Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights from the world of filmmaking. I'm Rob Newton, and today we are talking to cinematographer Baz Hardwin about his work on the popular Star Wars series, The Mandalorian. Baz is known for his work on Rogue One, a Star Wars story, There Will Be Blood, and of course The Mandalorian, which is a live-action series in the Star Wars franchise. It follows a lone bounty hunter as he makes his way through the outer reaches of the galaxy, far from the authority of the New Republic. Baz, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
Great. You have worked on some fantastic productions, by the way. Obviously, Rogue One, American Sniper, and of course, The Mandalorian, which we'll explore later. But before we get into that, I just wanted to explore a little bit about your background to the industry and what made you decide to take cinematography up as a career.
It was very interesting. It goes all the way back to high school when I was fascinated with the performing arts. And right after high school, I decided I didn't want to go to university like all of my friends. I went off to become doctors and lawyers and accountants, and I went and got a job at TV New Zealand as a photocopy boy. So I did that for a couple of years, and in the meantime was working on little small student films and things like that. Mm-hmm. Had a little foray at university, a failed foray at university, and then went off and did a film in Australia, a film in New Zealand, and then moved to Australia and did a couple of films there. And I was a PA or production assistant, but I knew that wasn't where I wanted to be, and I thought I maybe wanted to be a director at the time. But as I was learning about cinematography with all of the films that I was watching, I became more and more enamored with the idea of being a cinematographer. And I worked with a great Australian cinematographer, Paul Murphy, and ended up working for him full time for a couple of years as a clapper loader and running his equipment. And that was the best grounding and training for me to get started in the business.
Right. And, how would you describe your approach as a cinematographer?
Well, I'm inspired by the cinematography of Robert Ellsworth and some of the great cinematographers of the 70s and 80s. And so a naturalistic approach would be what I would go for, or what would be my strongest inspiration, you might say.
Mm-hmm. And moving on to American Sniper, which I really enjoyed, a great movie. I believe you were second unit director of photography on that.
I was. I was brought on by the DP Tom Stern to do additional photography. And Rob Lorenz, who was Clint Eastwood's longtime first AD and then producer, ended up creating a second unit with me shooting for him directing. And we were a great team, and we ended up shooting an extensive part of that film. It was really enjoyable to shoot photography that complemented Tom's, that satisfied Clint. He's a really interesting guy to work with, and yeah. In a good way. And it was a lot of fun, that film.
Yes, so that's your memories of it, I guess, in terms of shooting it, very positive. And were there any particular action scenes that you did you would like to share with us?
Well, obviously, we didn't, as second unit, we didn't really shoot anything that had Bradley on camera, but there was some great stuff that we shot in Morocco in the towns for the battles and attacks with all of the sniper work. There was also a great sequence that we shot in an Iraqi town that they had built in Santa Clarita in northern Los Angeles County, right. and there was some large sequences that we did in there that were very enjoyable when the Humvee was blown up by the IED, etc.
And a couple of years later, you worked on Rogue One with Greg Fraser, whom I think you've worked together with on The Mandalorian as well.
I did. I was introduced to Greg by John Hillcoat, a great Australian director who I'd done a number of commercials with and a pilot of a TV show. He had really appreciated my taste and energy level on set, and had introduced me to Greg, and then Greg got to appreciate me as well. And so we worked on a number of films and commercials in Los Angeles. And then he asked me to shoot second unit on Rogue One. And it was a great honor. It was a fantastic film to work on. It was such a magical Star Wars film. We tried and succeeded, I think, to capture the visual language and imagery that we all remember from the original Star Wars.
Yeah,
our memories of events are often more rosy, or more rosy implies a color, but are more optimistic, or have more detail or depth and beauty than actually the events might have actually had. That's the wonderful thing about the human spirit, is that we can optimize our memories so that we feel more positive about what happened back there. Anyway, so we wanted Rogue One to feel as strong as our memories were of the original Star Wars. And so it was a good goal, and I think it was well achieved because the film looked good and felt good.
Yeah, sure. I think, it was, for me, one of the better ones in terms of the, obviously you had the initial three, and then in terms of the spin-offs, I really, really enjoyed it and felt very engaged with it. Did you feel there was a lot of extra pressure with it being a Star Wars movie, with the passionate fans and people like to go into the detail of everything? Did that give you extra pressure?
I don't think pressure. No more pressure than Greg or I would put on ourselves to shoot something in the best possible way to make it as strong an image. I would sort of liken myself to the pressure that probably Roger Deakins tries to put himself under every shoot that he does to make. And I don't think he's ever done a Star Wars film. And yes, there are passionate fans, and they need to be part of the whole panoply of fans that are that would be satisfied by seeing it. So the passionate fans are an enjoyable part of working on Star Wars, not a pressure-inducing part of it. In fact, remind me about that later in the podcast when we talk about a bit more about Mandalorian.
All right, because that's what we, as I say, brings us to the Mandalorian now. And a live-action Star Wars television series, I think, was George Lucas's dream for many years. So how does it feel to be part of the team that actually achieved that?
Fantastic. That was an extraordinary experience. Kathy Kennedy and Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni wanted to bring this story to life, and they wanted Greg Fraser and I to come on board to shoot it. Mm-hmm. And it was with the very unusual LED wall technology that we used. Yeah. It was something that we'd trialed on a very large scale in Rogue One. But the technology back then was not such that we could shoot in that environment and have the backgrounds live as a final in camera. So the LED volume is a lighting volume that can create the most perfect lighting on the foreground elements. But traditionally in the past, whenever it was used on other films, let's say Gravity or First Man or even Rogue One, obviously, they had to replace the background. But the foreground lighting, the lighting on all of the cast, either in the cockpits or wherever they were, was very good, very accurate, and didn't require the complex VFX work that it normally requires. So it was fantastically exciting and challenging to work on Mandalorian because of this new technology, but it was also the first Star Wars show that's been shot in the US. And as you say, live action TV. We had to shoot 4.5 hours of footage, and 4.5 hours of edited footage. It was a massive undertaking.
Very much so. And I think the look of the show is fantastic. It very much reminds me of the original movies. And so, you know, where do you start when you need to create the Star Wars look and feel? You know, what are the key elements, you know, that help you create that iconic Star Wars look, if such a thing exists?
Well, part of it is going back to what Gil Taylor, who shot the first one, his equipment that he had available to move the camera. So it created certain types of camera moves and not other moves. The look of the film is again naturalistic. It feels that it's perhaps on another world, or in another, or on a spaceship, or a battleship, or a space a battle star, or stuff like that. But it doesn't feel nothing feels unmotivated or overly unreal. It feels like a real environment. It feels like a real corridor or a real planet. So, yes, maybe some of the planets have two suns, but that doesn't necessarily change the quality of the light, just what's in the background. So I think that would be the two main and an embracing of front light, occasional front light. You know, I'm sure that on every production there's an occasional moment where you're challenged with your shooting schedule and you end up doing a shot in front light that you really wish you hadn't. But there's a sense of reality that's imbued by, you know, the odd frontlit shot that is reminiscent of some of those Tatooine shots that they shot in Tunisia on A New Hope.
Yeah. And there's a visual language in the series which feels like sometimes an old Western movie, you know, and I think that works really well. So what were the choices to shoot some of the action that way? Why did you decide to do...
Well, I think George Lucas was motivated or inspired by a lot of the old Westerns and samurai films of maybe the 50s, but definitely the 60s. Those Western samurai tropes were all through the Star Wars series, certainly the first three. And that was definitely something that we wanted to riff on in The Mandalorian. The Mandalorian is a gunslinger and on the outer fringes of the galaxy, you know, essentially in a Western town. So all of those tropes were definitely in our back pocket for any shot that we were designing or any scene that we were blocking.
Sure. And you touched on it a little bit. Maybe we can expand now on the LED technology that you used, you know, to create and display the backdrops, as opposed to using green and blue screen. Could you just tell us how that operates and how that works? I know it's very complex, but in a simple way, and the advantages that brings to shooting the whole production.
So we call it the volume. It's basically a curved LED wall that's basically a circle, doesn't quite close the whole way. It goes to about 280 degrees. Mm-hmm. Then there's two big doors that almost close it, so nearly a 360-degree field of view, and a ceiling that's at about 7 meters high. And it's all LED technology, very fine pixel, so that we could pixel pitch, so that we could photograph it when it was slightly out of focus without seeing the pixels. So on the LED content, we would, on the LED walls, we would put content that was mostly a combination of combined photogrammetry and with a little bit of CG enhancement. So we might shoot something like some photogrammetry of the Death Valley, and then add some Star Wars props, you might say, in the background. And so then that was essentially displayed on the wall, and we would have a scene that we would be able to shoot on the foreground in the ground that was lit by the wall, and we could photograph the wall on the background. The other great game changer was that there was camera tracking. So as the camera boomed up or down or panned right, there was Parallax and Perspective Shift on the wall live, a little bit of latency, but basically live, so that we're basically shooting in a real world, real environment. So it meant that the actors could see where they really were as opposed to being in a green screen environment. The camera operators could frame up on the real things, the real horizon or the real mountains, so that you could make better choices for photography in that respect. And the foreground was lit perfectly by the content coming from the walls, so on the ceiling, so that it made the goal was for basically the background to be perfect and then the foreground to be perfectly lit, and therefore a seamless integration between the two, which is generally always the goal when you're shooting in a green screen environment, but you don't necessarily know what the background will exactly be in a green screen environment. Mm-hmm. And people don't necessarily photograph exactly how it should be in the green screen environment. If there's, let's say, if there's supposed to be a whole bunch of bright windows behind them, it's very difficult to, or might be a lot of DPs might be unwilling to blast what would be the appropriate type of light coming from those windows. But if you can actually see all of that on the contents and you're framing for it and exposing for it, then you're shooting in this volume that creates all of that photographic reality for you on a stage. So we tried to, the goal was to try and shoot at least half the film, half the project, the TV series, inside the volume. And that's what we did. So many different sets. One day we could be shooting in Tatooine. The next day we could be in Arvala, the mud planet. The art department would have to change all of the set dressing to accommodate, obviously. Or we could be inside Werner Herzog's office one day, and then in the streets of Navarro the next day, just by changing the foreground dressing on the and props and set dressing and props and the content on the walls, obviously.
So that must have brought great advantages both to the actors, the crew, and everyone, really, in terms of, as you said, the actors could visualize it, and obviously the crew could do that also. And as you said, in terms of speeding up the whole process, it must have been fantastic.
It was. It was very invigorating and enjoyable to work in that environment, to work in that tool. It was challenging at times, but ultimately incredibly rewarding.
Right. And which lenses did you use, to actually work with this? Were there special lenses? I know you used different ones to Rogue One.
We did. Rogue One, we used the Alexa 65 digital camera and Panavision Ultra Panavision 70s, which were very old lenses from the 50s and 60s that Bob Richardson had resurrected for Hateful Eight. I'd been given a call by Gregor Taverner, who was a really old friend of mine, Bob Richardson's camera assistant, when he told me he wanted me to come and have a look at these lenses that he was prepping for Hateful Eight. And they were beautiful. They were fantastic. And I mentioned them to Greg. Greg then also went down and had a look, and we did some testing with them, and that's what we used on Rogue One. We did a lot of extensive testing for The Mandalorian to work out what was the best camera sensor size, camera technology, and lens combination to make the most sense of what looked good inside the volume and was generally attractive and an appealing or pleasing lens package to shoot with. Greg and I have always been attracted to lenses with a little bit of funk and character in them. They're not necessarily perfect edge-to-edge. There might be a little optical vignetting or density vignetting or even a little bit of aberration through them, whether it's chromatic or optical. And we knew that we wanted to go anamorphic, and Panavision's anamorphics phenomenal. I love working with them. I've worked with them for most of my career. Mm-hmm. Dan Sasaki at Panavision created a couple of lenses that he was sort of toying with. And I asked him during the test, because we were having trouble finding the right lens package. I asked him if he had anything special floating around, and he did. He had these two Ultra Vistas, what they were calling them, because they're very wide. Mm-hmm. And very wide field of view. And so they were custom made for the Alexa LF. So with the size of that sensor, they needed to be a 1.65 squeeze anamorph to make the whole sensor, then a 239. It's really 237, but you just don't use the whole sensor native format. So we had an anamorphic lens on a large medium format sensor, and that was what we discovered was the magic lens and camera package to make the volume look as good as it could, and also sure. make the Mandalorian look as good as it could, good as he mm-hmm. could.
Right. And in terms of the backdrops, the virtual sets, I guess ILM were involved in all of that and the Unreal Engine work in creating them?
That's right. So there's quite a few videos of these online. ILM mm-hmm. have put one out. And it's the technology is displayed in or talked about in the current series of Gallery, which is about the making of Mandalorian on Disney Plus. Actually, last night there was an episode, maybe at the end of last week, there was an episode about the technology, which was very good if anybody wants to look at. But basically, we built the sets all digitally. The virtual mm-hmm. art department, led by Andrew Jones, who was the production designer, we would then analyze those sets and work out whether they needed to be, how big they needed to be, where they needed to be, what they needed to be part of, and what part needed to be completely digital and what part was practical, i.e. in the middle of the volume, where the blocking of the actors would be staged. So once Andrew Jones's and Doug Chang's virtual art department created those digital sets, they were given to ILM, who then transformed them through a few of their processes to make them photoreal and optimized mm-hmm. for the volume. And then we were, season one, we would then run them through Unreal Engine, a game engine basically, which gives us the ability to have the dynamic adjustment of the background for the camera tracking, and some adjustments and quite a bit of dynamic adjustment of the image, the quality of the image, whether it's color, gamma, density, and so that's how we ran the images on the wall. Season two, which we wrapped earlier this year, we ran through a different game engine. Very similar technology.
Sure. And I guess it helped an awful lot with all of the sunsets and, you know, when sunrises and some fantastic shots, you know, the magic hour scenes, having the flexibility of being able to create your own backdrops must have been, fantastic to help with that process.
Yeah, very enjoyable to do that. We could essentially... in a strong collaboration between myself or Greg Fraser and Andrew Jones and Richard Bluff, the VFX supervisor from ILM, we could create these environments, digital environments, you might say a backdrop, for a scene, and we could make it look exactly like we wanted to make it, whether it was beautiful or real or a mixture of both. Hopefully beautifully real, but I mean, sometimes, you know, you might get something that's not necessarily, I think something that is not necessarily perfect implies that it's real photography, that you've gone out on location and you've struggled to shoot a scene. Either the sun just set when you got there late because a car broke down, or you had a flat mm-hmm. tire, or you got to a location and it was just a little cloudier than what you expected it to be when you thought it would be sunny, or vice versa. So yeah. the mixture or combination of that, of those lighting looks is one of the great things that helps something look real. But yes, it was fantastic to be able to design the most beautiful sunsets or sunrises and then shoot them for the whole workday. So whether it's a 10 or 12 hour workday, you'd come to work in the morning and the dawn or the dusk would look like that all day. reminds me of a story on Michael Clayton, which is one of my favorite films. I was fortunate enough to work on it with Robert Ellsworth. There's a dawn sequence where George Clooney has just left Manhattan and driven up to the country. And he stops as the light's just starting to lift. The sun has not risen, but there's this sense of a gloomy dawn is coming. And he sees horses up on the hill, and he goes up to them because he's in need of some sort of communication or contact with a living being because of the despair he's feeling. And while he's up on the hill, his car blows up because somebody's blown it up, and so he runs off then into the mountains to escape. That took us a week of dawns and dusks to shoot that sequence. It was beautiful. The planning was extraordinary. The lighting and the look of that scene is fantastic. But we would have about half an hour to shoot each morning to do one or two shots each morning of the sequence. So on The Mandalorian, we could create, and we did many, many times, a dawn or a dusk that had that similar feel and of quality of light, but we would come to work in the morning and shoot there all day, go and have lunch, come back and shoot in the afternoon, and the light was still
incredible.
The light was still the same.
That's incredible, really is. Talking about the lighting then, I think something that you and Greg used before was digital Sputniks. Could you just explain what they are and how you use them and why?
Digital Sputnik is it's a great light. It's not particularly big. It's about the size. It's about 6 inches by 6 inches by 6 inches or so, roughly. Maybe 6 by 6 by 4. And they can be ganged together. So you can have it's a DS1 or a DS3 is three of them together, or DS6 is six of them. Or we made a couple of other bigger lights where there were like 20 or 40 or nearly 60, I think was our biggest one. There was a big amount of light output. It's a very good digital light, extremely good color control, very versatile. I believe in the first season we had about 800 heads. And we use them on every set for every imaginable type of use. It was a very versatile light.
Brilliant. And something that I know has been not an issue, but something to look at is with the costumes. Mandos, the stormtroopers, are very shiny and round and reflective surfaces. So. Obviously, you needed to try and avoid the reflections. I mean, was that an issue when you were shooting?
It was. One of the joys of shooting inside the volume is that the character is basically lit by the volume, so all of the reflections are accurate. Now, I had the ability, if there was not enough light coming from one side or the other, or too much from one side or the other, that I could actually grab digitally digital assets that were either on the wall or the ceiling, either clouds or buildings or mountains, and I could change the density or color of them so that they basically became lighting units. So it became big, broad-scale lighting tools by the amount of control that I had over different digital tools in the volume, basically. Obviously, the challenge was when there was a human face in there with Mando, so we would have to use lighting units, and then it was obviously a challenge then to stop them from being reflected in his armor, because he was a very big shiny ball.
Yes. Okay. During the prep time, what sort of pre-production tests did you do? I mean, did you have much time to prep?
Yes, it was a good amount of prep time. We had done some testing earlier in the year to check all of the technology worked. It was the first time it had ever been used. None of it was particularly new, but it had never been used together before in this fashion to do what we needed to do. Mm-hmm. So we had a big proof of concept test earlier in the middle of the year where we built a mini volume. And then after that, we then basically went into pre-production to start digitally creating these sets, digitally lighting them, and I had about 3 months of prep on season one.
Terrific. I've noticed the credits feature some concept art from each episode, which is quite striking. Was that something because you storyboarded the whole thing and the art was from the storyboards, or was it from the actual finished article?
Lucasfilm has got some phenomenal artists and designers, and Doug Chang is their lead Star Wars designer, lead international Star Wars designer. And so all of those concept art drawings are from him or his team. And that was an important part of the visualization of the written word at the beginning to understand what these environments would be. And then once that visualization had been created, then we had a starting point to go from Andrew Jones to build, to design the sets, and for Greg and myself to light them to understand what the environments were like. So that's all Lucasfilm, which is I can't speak highly enough of it.
Sure. No, I mean, it looks stunning, as I say. You mentioned that in terms of the prep, you had plenty of time, but what about the schedule? I mean, it's quite often on TV series, it's very tight. Was that the same here?
Yes, I'll just say yes. Yes, it was very tight. We're trying to make it look like a feature film, and we had to shoot, as I said, many hours of screen time. So yeah, the schedule was tight.
Right. Okay. I guess that brings its own pressure on everyone, but as you say, it's just part of a TV series, isn't it? And trying to get it out. So, in terms of post, were you given much time to actually do post for each episode?
My involvement in post was advisory during the VFX stage while they're working out deliverables for the VFX shots. Really, occasionally, a director would talk to me about an edit, but that wasn't necessarily my purview. But then I came in and I had 7 weeks of DI. We basically, or 8 weeks, we had a week of DI per episode, which was also a very tight schedule to get completed in time.
Right. You were saying that Rogue One was primarily shot in the UK, whereas The Mandalorian obviously was shot in the States. So I'm guessing there wasn't a lot of common crew between the two, or was there?
Well, Greg and I.
yeah, that's two.
I don't think there was anyone else. I don't think there was anybody from the English crew. Well, Kathy Kennedy, obviously.
Yeah.
I don't think there was anybody else that was in on Rogue One was on this project. No,
sure. John Knoll, was he on both?
Yes, you're right. John was the VFX supervisor on Rogue One. It was his baby. John had actually come up with the idea for Rogue One. And so he was very much involved with that as a passion project. Love working with John Knoll. He's definitely always the smartest man in the room. And then he was working from ILM on many of the sequences in post or VFX for post for Mandalorian. He came down to visit the set a few times, but he was more working from San Francisco.
Sure. But I guess knowing those guys, as you said, on Rogue One really helped on The Mandalorian in terms of, making a tighter team, if you like, at that sort of level.
Yeah, so it was good because it was – Rogue One was obviously considered quite successful and everyone very much liked the look of it. And so John Favreau, Dave Filoni, and Kathy Kennedy specifically had hired Greg and I so that we could bring that look to The Mandalorian. So there was a great sense of support from all of them for us to do that.
Terrific. Fantastic, yeah. And there's one element which we haven't discussed yet, and I shall bring it up, which is the child. which my daughter's, 13 now, and we were watching it again last night. We watched the whole series. She obviously loves it. Is it a fan favorite over in the States as much as it is in the UK?
It's a global fan favorite. Everybody loves the baby, the child. We loved working with it on set. There's a great story of Werner Herzog is talking to it and relating to it, and it was this most extraordinary animatronic puppet. But it controlled by three or four people with wireless controls, and it's a beautiful character. It's a beautiful little character. It's a great foil for the Mando, and the two of them are a great team. So, I mean, I don't know if it's a he or a she. We never knew, the child was wonderful to work with.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's certainly, as you say, one of the great things about the series, I think, is there's lots of characters in there that you can develop over the series. You know, series one, series two, series three, and I think that's something people are looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. Season two will be very much enjoyed.
Excellent. Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. Of all the great scenes in the series, and there are a lot, can you describe one of your favourite ones and what made it special for you?
Well, the child was obviously really enjoyable to work with. There's that moment where he's in the cockpit with Mando, and the child is reaching over and flicking switches, and Mando says, "Stop that." And the kid just turns around and looks at Mando and then reaches back behind him and flicks the switch again. And there's just this great sense of character development at that point as Mando's developing, you know, some communication or relationship or as Mando's developing a communication and a relationship with the child.
Sure, yeah. And I think anyone with children of their own was probably nodding furiously when it was doing all those antics.
Yes.
we've all been there. You were nominated for Outstanding Virtual Cinematography in a CG Project for The Prisoner, Chapter 6. How did you feel about that? And what do you think in that episode in particular, why it was selected?
Well, that was a great episode. There was the scene takes place in two places, which is the roost hangar, we called it, which was the space knock shop or chop shop, where the gang of hoodlums are pulling spaceships apart and selling parts off for scrap. And that was a huge, big, fantastic digital environment that was complex and fantastic and enjoyable to shoot on in the volume. Of course, we had Bill Burr acting, who was fantastic. And then we were in the prison ship, and the prison ship was enjoyable to shoot in as well. It was a whole bunch of corridors and strange aliens and behind doors, and it was a very unusual episode for us. Rick Famuyiwa wanted it to feel different from the other episodes, which that was the goal, and that's what we did. Mm-hmm. I was thrilled to be nominated by the VFX Society for an award. It was I was disappointed that I lost.
Yes, yeah. But it certainly looked fantastic.
Happy to be nominated, obviously.
Yes. as I say, we need to unfortunately wrap the podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Baz, and thanks for your time today in the Visual Impact podcast.
Thanks, Rob. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope you guys are doing okay in these times of COVID.
Yeah. You too. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
That was cinematographer Baz Arduin talking about his work on Star Wars: The Mandalorian. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcast blogs and exclusive Visual Impact content by going to our website, visuals.co.uk.